Howdy. This is a fuck.
Welcome to the fail.
No. I got this. All right.
Welcome to the Art of the Fail. This is a podcast hosted by Christian Borgazan, co-founder of Arch, and myself, Chris Buttonham, co-founder of Obi.ai. We sit down with startups and entrepreneurs, or anyone interesting willing to sit down with us. We hope that we uncover lessons and anecdotes, but if not, we hope you get a laugh.
Nobody likes this shit. Let's just get started with the show.
So today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by Obi. Yes, Obi. Seeing as Christian slept in for this interview, I felt it was only fitting to hijack the sponsor slot. Do you ever get frustrated trying to find a document at work? I know, me too. So I'm rushing to a call, and literally 5 minutes before the thing, I'm sifting through Google Drive. Wait, or was it in Dropbox? To try and find my discovery call notes template. But now, with the brand new Obi browser extension, I can just quickly hit Command-Shift-O, type in a few keywords, and boom, I've got all of my work documents within reach. And I can continue to prepare for meetings 5 minutes in advance. Also, in light of a lot of companies shifting to remote work amidst the pandemic, Obi is now free for personal use. What this means is, even if your organization hasn't adopted Obi yet, you can accelerate your own work for free. And look, I wear a lot of hats as a startup founder, as I'm sure you do as well. You know, closing sales, supporting customers, collaborating on product or marketing. All of these functions rely on a ton of knowledge and documentation. So why don't you head over to obi.ai/personal today and install the free browser extension to build your own single source of truth. That's obi.ai/personal.
All right, welcome back to the Art of the Fail. You might be wondering why you hear my voice and not Christian's. Well, today I am joined by my partner in crime, actually, for obi.ai, Alex Sapinka. He is the quieter, more docile, and clearly more reliable version of Christian. Alex, Correct. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I've been bugging Chris to come on for 3 years now, and he's not ready to let me on as a guest to talk about failure, but he's letting me co-host at least a little bit here.
Awesome. Why don't you introduce our guest today?
So we have April Dumford, founder of Ambient Strategy. She helps companies of all sizes go to market strategy and their marketing positioning. She's also an entrepreneur in residence at the DMZ and an alumna of my alma mater, University of Waterloo.
Oh, another Waterlooser.
Yes.
That's nice.
Oh. So welcome to the show, April.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
We have some rapid fire questions to start off.
Sure.
So the first is, what'd you have for breakfast this morning?
I literally didn't have anything for breakfast this morning. Is that bad? I had coffee, and not even proper coffee because I gave up caffeine. So I had decaf coffee for breakfast. Is that lame?
You'd be surprised how many times we've gotten that answer.
Yeah, this is like the art of the fail right here. Yeah. I failed at breakfast. I failed before I even got going this morning.
Yeah.
But I did succeed in not having any caffeine. I feel good about that if nobody else does.
Yeah, definitely.
What did I have for breakfast? What kind of a question is that?
Well, it leads me into my next one. How many cups of coffee do you drink every day?
Well, see, this dovetails into the first one. So I never used to drink that much coffee, but I think apparently I've read about this, that some people are really sensitive to caffeine. So caffeine kind of wires them up more than regular people. And I never drank that much coffee, but I switched offices. And in my new office, there's this communal coffee pot. And I don't know what they're doing with that coffee, but it is like three times the caffeine of any coffee I've ever drank in my life. And so I started drinking this coffee, and it was killing me. By the end of the afternoon, I was getting really punchy. Like I'd be on calls, and I'm like, answer faster. And I had somebody say, April, you're a little intense when we have calls later in the afternoon. And so I decided, you know what, that coffee, I decided that was it. And so I thought I would do an experiment and quit caffeine. And I did. And that actually, I'm a more pleasant person to deal with in the afternoons. And so, yeah, but I still like a hot drink in the morning, and I'm not a tea person all that much. So I drink decaf now, which is like just kind of terrible coffee that doesn't make you jittery. But yeah, and so maybe I drink one of those. But so the answer is none. I don't drink any.
It must be some of that fair trade, grass-fed hipster coffee.
Well, sometimes you do get hipster decaf. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
But not anywhere near me, man. Well, I don't know. all the coffee I'm drinking is legit terrible. But it's force of habit, I think. Yeah. I could give up the caffeine easily, but the habit of getting a coffee in the morning, I haven't been able to give up.
I agree.
Yeah, same. iPhone or Android?
I'm totally Android.
Oh, nice, yeah. Nice. We're clawing back the Android.
I got a story about that.
Okay.
So I went to school like you at the University of Waterloo, and then my first job out of school was at a startup in Waterloo. And in fact, the CTO of that startup left to go be the CTO of this tiny, tiny little company called Research in Motion. And so we all had Blackberries when there were no smartphones. And that was the only thing you could get. And we had those for years before there was an iPhone. And then when the iPhone came up, it was so cool looking and everything. But I had to give up so much to switch. Like, if you were already using a smartphone, you didn't go to iPhone because, you know, I couldn't roam in Europe. I couldn't roam in Europe until the iPhone, the third one or the fourth one, which just blew my mind. I was like, I can't give up roaming in Europe. I got all kinds of business in Europe. So I never went iPhone. And I just, if you don't, you just don't. And so, yeah, I'm Android.
I would agree with that. I'm a hardcore veteran BlackBerry user until I had to just make the switch to Android. So
yeah, I think that checks out. We're actually really, really early smartphone adopters were Android for that reason, because they're like, oh, it looks so cool, and there's all those, you know, I could do tap to fart. You know, in the beginning where the App Store was just all these stupid games? Like, yeah. And so the iPhone people would come to me and say, you could give up roaming in Europe for tap to fart. And I'm like, no, I don't want to roaming in Europe for tap to fart. I'm not doing it. And then, you know, now, of course, they're all equal as far as I'm concerned. I don't think there's any difference one or the other. But you know, I'm used to Android, and all my stuff's on Android, and I'm all Google Suite and stuff. It would be too painful to switch now.
Yeah, for me it was
yeah.
Oh yeah, like half price,
right?
Yeah, for me it was I'm a software programmer, so BlackBerry used Java programming language, and then Android was also Java. Right. so
were you computer science or engineering at Waterloo?
Neither. It was math.
You were math.
Yeah.
Math.
Which is essentially computer science, but
which is computer
that's
science.
Another
it's the same thing. You're still in there, and you're still in that building.
Yeah. The cement the cement cube.
Yeah.
Next question. Do you prefer written or audiobooks?
Written books, and actually I have a book out right now. I just released a book in May, and I decided to put out the wait on the audio version, because I thought, well, maybe it's a crappy book and nobody wants it, so I sell some work by not doing an audio book of a book nobody wants to read. But then the book has turned out to be kind of popular, but oh man, people are on my case about the fact that I don't have an audio book and I really need to get it. But I know I'm not much of an audio book person, but you know, I say that, and my kids are super audiobook people, and you know, one of my kids hates to read, and the other one loves reading, and one of them I think is just wired for reading and the other one isn't, but they both listen to a lot of audiobooks in addition to reading books. But me, I do ebooks. I have a Kindle, but I read them, I don't listen to them.
Awesome. And that book is obviously awesome, right?
Yeah, that's the title as well as the description.
Exactly. Yeah, nice positioning.
Awesome. Yeah, it's a book about positioning. It's cool. People seem to like it. But yeah, I put it out back in May, but I'm now working on the audio version, or I'm trying to figure out when to do it. I'm on a bit of a book tour right now.
Okay.
And so that runs until sort of November. I'm on the road a lot, but then December, I think I'll do an audiobook version. So there'll be great joy in the land when I put this thing out. Man, I'm getting a lot of static from the techies in particular. Yeah. I think a lot of folks just strictly audiobook.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that, but I just haven't got around to making one yet, but I'm gonna, and when I do, it's gonna be awesome.
Great. You heard it here on the Art of the Fail.
Yeah.
Awesome. So that book is available, obviously, awesome, on Amazon, anywhere you buy books, I'm sure. And we'll put the link to the description, link to the book in the description, as well as maybe a little pop-up here that shows the book as well. Alex, last question?
Yes, last question, still on the books. Aside from obviously awesome, what's the best book you've read in the past year?
In the past year.
Or ever, if you can't think of the past year.
Yeah, you know, I've read a lot of good books in the last few years. I really enjoyed Atomic Habits. I know everybody's reading that book right now, but I really enjoyed Atomic Habits. It really got me thinking about why I do what I do and thinking about changing my own behavior. I thought that was a good book. And then I met this gal at a conference, Melissa Peary, that wrote a book called The Build Trap, which if you're on the product management side of things, I think is an excellent, excellent read. You know, for the work that I do, like, I get asked a lot, like, are there any books that really influenced you? And like, my work is mainly centered on positioning, and there's kind of only one book on the subject that anybody's ever read, which is this book called Positioning: The Battle for Your Mind. But it's super old. It came out in 1982.
Oh, wow.
Which is like before the internet. But if you go learn positioning in school, it's still kind of the reference book that people keep coming back to. And they sort of coined the term positioning. They defined the term positioning. So I always recommend that people read that book if they want to just get a better feel for what positioning is. The problem, though, with that book, and the reason I wrote mine to a certain extent, is that the book described what positioning was, but it didn't tell you how to do it.
Yeah.
The idea was,
it's not tactical.
Yeah, you were supposed to call them. It was marketing is what it was. So when people say there was no content marketing back in the olden days before the internet, I say, oh, no, read this book. Mm-hmm. This is an excellent example of content marketing before the internet. So, yeah, the idea was you were supposed to read the book, get the religion, and then call them. And they were an advertising agency, and they would do it for you. But I still recommend that book a lot. I do think it is kind of the master reference work on how to do – on how to think about this stuff. Then if you want to do it, you're going to have to go read my book or do something else or to do it like me the hard way and just figure it out slowly and poorly. But I think that's a good book too. I think people should read it.
Awesome. Great. April, thank you so much again for joining us. I think it's time to jump into some failures. But before we do, I would love for you just to give our listeners a little bit more context into who you are. You know, how did you get here, and why did you fall in love with this particular niche that you have fallen into?
Yeah, so my background, I think, has a lot to do with that. So, you know, as we mentioned earlier, I did systems design engineering at the University of Waterloo. And so when I finished, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And I ended up getting a job at a startup kind of by accident. Like, my friend worked there. I didn't know what I was going to do when I was done. She worked there. She put in a word for me, and I got a job in a product marketing role, which sat inside the marketing department. So here I was, I have an engineering degree. I'm doing what's technically a marketing job. And that company grew really fast, got acquired, and then my boss left. And I inherited the marketing team of a $2 billion revenue company and like one division inside that. And I had 30 some people working for me and this great big budget. And I literally can't spell marketing. Like, I've never even taken a marketing class. Like, I got nothing. But one thing that, you know, University of Waterloo is kind of a fancy school, and so it's really hard to get in. And then systems design, when I was there, was kind of the fancy program at the fancy school. And so if there's one thing you got from systems design was just this kind of ego that was like, how hard could it be? And it can't be worse than mechanics of deformable solids. That was hard. And so I decided I was just going to muscle my way through it and figure it out. So I read a lot of books. I had really smart people on my team that I learned a lot from, and I took a bunch of courses. And that was where I first got introduced to the concept of positioning, which was interesting because I had already done it with the product that I was working on. We had repositioned it. But I didn't know that's what it was called, and I didn't know what I was doing. And we ended up with really good positioning in the market, but it was kind of trial and error. So I thought, this is really interesting. Here you've got this really important thing. I wonder how you do it. And eventually I'll get to that course. And so I ended up leaving that company. I went to another startup. We did the same thing. We had a product. I repositioned it. We grew really fast. We got acquired. And I did that. Essentially, I ended up working at 7 different startups as an executive. 6 of those startups got acquired, which resulted in me working at 5 really big companies. And across all those companies, all 7 startups plus the big ones, I launched 13 products into market. And every single one of those, I repositioned at some point. And so I, you know, after the 3rd or 4th one, I'm like, what the heck? We do this every time. Like, there should be a methodology to do this. As my engineering brain told me this. There must be a methodology. We can't just make this stuff up. So I took a bunch of classes, and it turns out marketers are really snobby about where you take a class. Like, I took some classes, and I'd say, how do you do positioning? I haven't figured that out yet. And they said, that's because you're taking the wrong classes. And I'm like, oh. And they were like, where'd you take the class? And I said, University of Toronto. And they were like, never heard of it. Wrong course. And I was like, well, where am I supposed to take it? They're like, Northwestern. That's where the marketing people go. I said, all right. So I went and took this intensive sort of post-grad thing at Northwestern, and I'm taking this class, and there's a module on position. It's actually not even a module. It's one class on positioning. So I'm like, okay, finally, I'm going to learn this thing about positioning. The professor gets up and he says, we're going to learn about positioning. And he puts this thing up called a positioning statement. And if you're in marketing, you've probably seen this thing. It's like a fill in the blanks, Mad Libs kind of thing. You know, we are a blank for blank that does blank without, you know, in versus blank. And so you put in who your competitors are and what your segmentation is and all this stuff. And so he puts this thing up. He talks about it for a little bit. He explains what each of the blanks are. Market category is the category that you're in, blah, blah, blah. He explains what a market category is. And then he starts moving on to the next topic. And I'm sitting at the back of the room, and I had just repositioned a product that we had originally positioned it as a personal use database, and we repositioned it as an embeddable database for mobile devices. This giant shift in positioning. And so I put up my hand, and I'm like, dude, like, one of those blanks is market category. So how do I know what the right market category is? Because, like, for example, I'm just at this company. We did this thing, and, you know, we were one market category and the product was failing. We shifted to another market category and the product took off. So how would I have known that there was a better one? Like, how do I figure out market category? And the guy did this thing where he looked at me, and he's like this old guy, you know, and he's got his glasses. He's like total professor type. And so he's up at the front, and he does this thing where his glasses are all down his nose, and he squints, and he does this thing where he looks at me over his glasses, and he says, and I'm like, how do you know which market category? And he squints up at me and he goes, trust me, April, you'll just know.
That's a great answer.
I'm like, what the hell kind of answer is that? Yeah. You know, and again, my little engineering brain was like, no, life doesn't work like that. I didn't just know mechanics of deformable solids. And what do you think? We're all dummies? Half the people on my founding team have a PhD in something. We're not idiots. And we didn't just know. Like, there must be a way to figure it out. So then that sort of became this thing that vexed me for like 10 years. I was like, and so eventually that's how I got to be this positioning weirdo. So, you know, eventually I decided, you know, you can take positioning and break it into pieces. And, you know, and positioning has 5 component pieces, it turns out. And they're the blanks of the positioning statement. market category, competitive comparables, unique features, value, and customers. So I can break it into that. And then I thought, well, you just have to figure out what the right answer is for each of the pieces. Then I'll have a methodology. But when you dig into it, it's actually really hard because all the pieces relate to each other. Like, your differentiated value is dependent on your unique features, but your features are only unique if you're comparing them to a competitor. And your market category is actually the context where your value makes the most sense to your target customer. So where do you start? And so eventually I came up with a methodology and a flow where you start in a certain place, you get to another place. The book is all about that. But to answer your question, how do I get here? That's how I got here.
That's interesting.
A bit of falling into things and self-learning, and then a bit of, you know, me looking at marketing professors like, why don't we know this? We should know this. You're saying we don't have a, like, yeah.
That's so an awesome story. I love when, you know, people are doing something that came out of a passion. And I didn't think about this coming into the conversation, but just hearing you talk about positioning, how much overlap do you get with product market fit methodologies?
Oh gosh. Like honestly, we could have a whole podcast.
Yeah, I bet we could.
So fundamentally, at a kind of gut level, I don't believe in product market fit. I don't think that that's a thing. Hmm. And the reason I don't think it's a thing is because anytime we have a conversation about product market fit, we get into, how do you know if you have product market fit? And the answer to that question is, we don't.
Subject.
So if I don't know whether I've got it or not, is it a useful construct for me? Like, and as the head of marketing, the repeat head of marketing at a set of different startups, you know, I've had some people tell me that product market fit is the moment where you know you can put your foot on the gas in marketing. And I'm like, no, it ain't. Because every single company I ever came into, if you ask them, did they have product market fit? They'd say yes. And I'd say, why do you think that? And they'd say, because I have a whole bunch of customers and I surveyed them and they said they would be super disappointed if the product went away. So I have product market fit. And I'm like, great, describe your market. And none of them can. So what I would do then is I'd say, look, we know we have fit, if you want to call it that. We know that a certain group of customers really loves our stuff. What we don't know is why. And we don't know what is it about that customer that makes them a really good fit for our product. So I don't need product market fit. What I need is an actionable customer segmentation. Mm. What's that? That's a thing I can use to build programs on. So if you come to me and say, small businesses love our stuff, I cannot build you a marketing program for small businesses. It's too vague. Yeah, I literally worked for a company where he said, our target market is Fortune 1000 companies. And I'm like, what, we just write a list? There's 1,000 and that's it? We're going to sell every single one of them? And the thing we did was software that helped you deliver an internal build software project. So I'm like, what if I don't build software, but I'm a Fortune 1000 company because I'm like a mining company or something? And the CEO says, no, we don't target them. And I'm like, well, we don't use this at tech companies. So what if I'm a tech company? Oh yeah, tech companies. We take those off the list too. And I'm like, well, wait, what if I'm a Fortune 2000 company, but I build a lot, a lot, a lot of software inside. So I really need this thing. Then am I a target? Yes. Okay. This company's doing 40 million revenue. They obviously have, you know, if I said, do you have product market fit? They'd say yes, but I still can't put my foot on the gas because I can't answer any questions that allow me to put my foot on the gas. So we dig into it and then we find out who actually really, really loves our stuff. It turns out if you're doing internal software development projects and your development teams are distributed, then our value proposition is chef's kiss. Everyone loves it, right? So then I say, okay, how do I know if you have a distributed development team or why do you have a distributed development team? Two reasons. One, you did an acquisition and there was a development team, or you did many acquisitions. So the development teams are spread out all over the place because you keep acquiring them. And two, you decided to outsource it or offshore it. And so you have remote development teams doing part of the work and onshore development teams doing another part of the work. Now ask me, April, can you build me a marketing plan to go sell to people that outsource software development? Oh, this is easy peasy lemon squeezy. Like, it's so easy, right? I can, like, Before, these people were running webinars on like how to manage a good internal software project. Now I'm running a webinar on, oh my God, you got outsourced teams and you have no idea how to manage that project. I'm going to help you manage it. That is really specific. Mm-hmm. And the only people that are going to show up to that are people that have offshore stuff. Do you know that there's a magazine called Outsourcers Weekly? And you can buy a full page ad in that magazine for $5,000. And I drove so much money advertising in that thing. It's ridiculous, right? So product market fit, for me as a head of marketing at a startup, I'm like, I don't know what it is, and I don't care what it is, because nobody knows if they have it or they don't have it. Do you know who loves product market fit and wants it to be a thing? VCs.
Yeah.
Because product market fit represents the exact perfect moment to write you a check.
They can deploy capital, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so they want it to be a thing so bad that they're writing blog posts and they're doing all this stuff and they're trying to convince everybody that product market fit is a thing. When it, and the reason the startups care about it is because when they go in to pitch to VCs to get money, the VCs are like, have you found product market fit? And so what's the answer to that? Yes.
Of course.
Yes. But it's not useful to me as a person who's trying to drive revenue operationally inside a business. And if it is not useful to me operationally inside the business, then I'm like, it ain't even a thing. So that's my rant.
That's so awesome. That's
now here's the thing. So what's the difference between product market fit and positioning? Positioning is actually a thing. It's actually a thing.
Right.
And part of positioning is deeply understanding what is my differentiated value and what is the actionable customer segmentation that matches that. So who cares about that value and why? If I can answer that, then I can size that market. And I can tell you how much revenue I can drive out of that. I can build programs around it. Then I can put my foot on the gas. So if you have verified strong positioning, then am I ready to put my foot on the gas and scale like crazy? Yes. So maybe what we should be doing is instead of sitting around trying to decide whether, you know, consult the tarot cards and the chicken bones and dice to see whether or not we've got product market fit, maybe what we should do is just focus on getting an actionable customer segmentation, and then we would have something that we could actually action on instead of this hoo-ha. Again, it's investors want this to be a thing, not typical people inside the company. If investors weren't talking about it, we'd all stop talking about it.
I couldn't agree more. And that's for our product and our startup focused listeners. What a unique and different opinion. I'm super glad that
thing is it's not. It's just people are scared to say that because the investors will be like, oh, you don't know. You'll know. It's just like my professor about the positioning. You'll just know. Like
that's half the problem.
I'm like, that's such bullshit. I just don't believe it. But every time that so on Twitter, I went on this rant once where I don't think product market fit is a thing. And I got like 1,000 likes. Like, I am not alone on this. There are tons of people that believe this is true, but they're quiet about it because if you ever want to raise money, you can't admit that you don't believe it's a thing. Me, and I'm not raising any problem, money
right?
anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I can say it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's a good segue to if it's possible to narrow in on the top product positioning failure for startups or just companies in general, top three if they're short and succinct.
Well, the biggest thing, and again, because I ended up doing so many startups because of the startups I was at kept getting acquired, like because I've been in so many, you could start seeing the patterns. And the biggest pattern I saw in terms of, you know, things we get wrong about positioning, like the most obvious, largest one is we just don't think about it. Like, we don't position deliberately. So we have positioning, we just kind of fell into it. And what I mean by that is most of the companies I worked at, the founders had created the product with a particular positioning in mind. They had a particular target customer. They thought they were delivering a particular value. So the very first product I ever worked on, it was a little database product, and we built it because a customer asked us to build it, and then we thought, we'll release this to everybody. And what it was a really lightweight, low footprint database that you could put on your PC and it ran SQL. And this was like 1,000 years ago, like back in the 90s. And back in the 90s, if you wanted an SQL database, you had to put it on a server because it took up all kinds of space. And it was really hard to install and configure. And if you wanted to do quote unquote database stuff on your PC, people used things like Microsoft Access, which was crap, and it didn't run SQL. And so if you wanted to run structured query language on a PC, you couldn't do that without a lot of hassle. So we built this thing that was like Microsoft Access, except it ran SQL, and you could just, you know, click, 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 install it on your PC. So we thought, we're techie people, right? We're like, who wouldn't want one of those? Everybody wants one of those, right? And it turns out nobody wants one. But that's the way we were positioning it, right? We you know, and we put it out in the market. And it didn't sell very well, and you know, it sold a little, but it wasn't our main product, and we almost killed it at one point because we're like, why are we even selling this thing? It's just costing us money and whatever. But luckily we didn't. Like what we did do was I went on this thing where I basically got a list of all the customers, and I talked to everybody about what are you doing with it, what do you like, what do you don't. And it turned out even the customers we had, like basically everybody hated it. Like they thought it was going to be cool to have SQL on a thing. And then they got it and they were like, you know what? I could actually just do this with macros in a spreadsheet. And I didn't know, you know, so I bought it, but I never even used it. Like there was a lot of this. And so that sucked. And then, but I had a handful of customers that were super happy. And the common thing across the customers that were super happy was they were using it on a laptop. And you know, again, this is like 1,000 years ago, like laptops were new. And so they had it on a laptop. And what they said, you know, what's really cool is if I got a database on a laptop that runs SQL, I can sync it with a database back in headquarters. And so one guy basically had his sales team out on the road with laptops with this little database underneath, and they could take orders on the laptop. And then when they get back to headquarters, just sync it up. And no one could do that before. And so I found this handful of customers that all had this unique use case. So I took that back to the office and said, maybe there's something there. Maybe we should do that. And so, you know, so there was this discussion around maybe that's what it is. And so, you know, we tested that. We had some, you know, but the thought of changing that positioning was kind of scary because that changed everything. It did, like the pricing structure would have to be different. The product roadmap would have to be different. We wouldn't be able to sell it the same way. Like we were selling it, you know, like B2C, and we were going to have to actually have a sales team and go out and sell these things by the hundreds. And so it was kind of a scary shift. And we made the decision and we dipped a toe over there, and it turned out the thing took off like wildfire. Like it was actually crazy. We sold so many, it was crazy. And then that company ended up getting acquired by a big database company called Sybase, which at the time was the biggest database company mm-hmm. in the world. And then our thing became a division inside Sybase. And at one point that was a $1 billion business line.
Wow.
This little thing that, you know, we almost canned it because it didn't look like anybody wanted it. But had we been so that's an example of like we just did this default mm-hmm. positioning. But mm-hmm. had we gone through a process, we would have said, you know, okay, what's our real competitor? Our real competitor is Microsoft Access, but it's also spreadsheets and whatever. And then what do we have that they don't have? Well, this idea that it was we knew that SQL was unique, but we didn't think enough about the idea that it was really small footprint and really easy to install made us a perfect fit for mobile devices. And we were like the only, and then, you know, this idea that because it's SQL and on a mobile device, now what can we do? And we didn't do enough thinking about what that unique feature, set of features together could enable for a customer. And then how we could potentially position that. And had we have done some deep thinking about that, we would have got to this thing earlier. And, you know, and as it was, we got there, but it was just lucky because some customers decided to use it that way. But we could have been unlucky and never had a customer try it. And we would have never thought about going that path ourselves. So that's the biggest thing that people get wrong is they fail to deliberately position the product. They just kind of fall into the positioning that was in their mind when they built it.
What a cool story. I guess that goes to show, well, you've had a track record of turning these things around, you know, with positioning at the helm. So that's super cool.
I think a lot of successful products, it's funny how a lot of successful products, if you dig into the stories, you know, there's a shift in positioning that mm-hmm. happens at some point. It's just, maybe you didn't know what you were doing.
Yeah.
Or maybe you didn't know what to call it. But, you know, you learn something about your customer base and your product and where the intersection of those two things happens in a really glorious, amazing, magical way. And that's where a lot of really successful products come from. It's like, well, we built this thing and it was terrible and it didn't really work. But then we had this kind of insight about, hey, we could take this and use it in this way. And then, woof. Mm-hmm. And almost every product I ever worked on that became really successful, it went like that.
That's been Alex and I's story. We, a year and a half ago, we repositioned our product that just wasn't working. And we're still solving the same problem with a completely different positioning. And like you said, it was the unique insight that we learned from failing the first time that
exactly.
was actually the secret sauce in what is now what we'd like to think a successful product. So,
well, that's it, right? Like, it's the failure that makes you go looking
yeah.
for,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
Like, if it wasn't failing and the thing was working, then, you know, you don't have a problem and everything's fine.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about that is I've worked at companies where the positioning was great at the beginning.
Right.
And so the default positioning was fine and that worked fine until something happened. So, you know, a competitor came in the market, or there was a shift in technology, or there was a shift in the economy, or like shit happens. and then all of a sudden a thing that was working isn't working. And so then that's where everybody's like, oh gosh, you know, maybe it's a marketing problem. Maybe it's a sales problem. But sometimes the root of this thing is actually the market has shifted. It's therefore requiring a shift in positioning. But because we've never actually deliberately positioned the thing before, we don't even know how to fix that.
That's interesting. That's sort of the question that I was going to ask on that. Do you think that because some companies are lucky enough to, you know, get success from that default positioning, that they've sort of built
yeah.
muscle memory around not knowing how to reposition?
Well, I think that, you know, I think everybody has the ability to reposition
yeah.
a product
mm-hmm.
if they're thoughtful about it. But I do think that sometimes these ones that have, you know, early success, you know, they have this idea that yeah, I can predict this stuff. And I just know that, you know, it's like my marketing professor, you just know.
Yeah.
right?
yeah.
And the VCs are all telling me, you'll know product market fit when you have it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so they think it's a thing that they should just know. And so when things go bad, some folks I think will default flip to, well, it must be a poor execution problem. So growth is slow because our sales team sucks, or growth is slow because we're just not tapping the right customer acquisition channels. So we just need more leads. That's
right.
all we need, more leads.
Yeah.
We just, you know, let's fire the head of marketing, get a new one, wave the magic wand, get more leads,
mm-hmm.
and then everything will be fixed. And you're not used to checking into, whereas if you had to struggle to get to the right positioning, then I think you naturally have this worry and this suspicion that you could lose it. And so you're more likely to check in on it if things are going bad rather than default to, well, it must be execution. I think you're more likely to say, are all our assumptions about our target market still correct?
Right.
And, you know, are we really selling for this reason, or has something happened and now we're selling for different reasons? And you're more likely to check in on it, I think. So,
yeah. Before we move on, speaking of ancient laptops, Alex, what was your first laptop? Didn't it have a handle?
Yeah, it was like a suitcase.
like a boat anchor?
So at that company that I worked at, we were always laughing because this was like in the early days of laptops. So, you know, the sales and marketing team, we had laptops, but the developers didn't have laptops. They had great big boxes. And so at one point they were all complaining that, you know, they wanted to take their stuff home to be able to work at home. And so the CEO went and he screwed handles on the tops of the boxes. And so you would see the guys in the dev team going out like, you know, home hardware, like, you know, metal handle on the top.
That's
and
awesome.
And so we used to always talk about that. We used to call it developer laptop.
That's awesome.
It's a portable computer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Um, April, one of the interesting things about your story, I think, is when you took over, and correct me if I'm wrong, I have limited context here. When you took over as CEO for a company called Sprintly, and yeah. I actually just on Twitter the other day, we had already had this podcast scheduled, and I saw somebody asking about, hey, does anyone have any good examples of where a CEO that wasn't the original founder took a company to success? And your name was mentioned. I was like, oh, that is interesting. Oh,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, you don't hear that often.
I'm not sure I would say I took that company to success, but maybe. And I didn't do it without the founder as the other piece that they don't know. So Sprintly was a really special case. So this was the product of a drunken conversation between so here's the history of the company. So Joe Stump, who I've known for a long time, is a super smart guy, and he's founded a bunch of companies. And he one of the companies that he founded was this company, Sprintly, and it was in the project management space, which is a terrible space. Like, if you were going to do a new startup right now, it's probably the last thing I would recommend you do, because there's so many products in that space. It's really crowded. And then there's lots of big companies and the big established products like Trello and Jira. Like, you just don't want to be in that space. But anyway, so he had this company raise some money. It grew pretty well. But sales kind of plateaued, you know, because the space was super crowded, and he ended up selling it. And, anyways, fast forward a few years after that, he and I were both speaking at a conference, and you know, and at the end of the day, we all go to the bar, we're drinking beers, and we got talking about how there are a lot of perfectly good SaaS companies that look like failures because they're not growing fast enough to get VC investment, but they're very, very good small businesses, and you know, and it's a good piece of software, and the customers don't churn because they like it and whatever. So we're having that conversation about how, you know, because we're both kind of haters about traditional VC, and so we were talking about that, and he said, well, yeah, like, and he started talking about Sprintly. He said, I've got one of these, like, you know, it's still got thousands of paying customers. The customers love it. They call me all the time. You know, it's owned by this other company right now, and they're kind of neglecting it because it's not really core to their business. But, you know, I always thought, you know, I should just run that company because it's this nice little business and it's not growing super fast, but that's okay. Who cares? You know, and you got these customers and they're all happy. And so I was, and he's like, we should buy that thing back. And, you know, we're at the bar drinking. Like, it sounds like a great idea. We're like, yeah, cheers. You know, yeah, let's buy that thing. And then we did.
Oh, wow.
Like, it's the crazy thing. So, we, you know, our timing was really good. And that, you know, we called them and they were, you know, doing some downsizing and stuff. And it was a good time for them to get rid of the asset. And so they just sold it. They just sold us the asset. And he was the original founder, though. Like, I would have never done that without him. Like, it, like, he knew where all the bodies were buried in the code. And the code base had been a little neglected, you know, in the years that he wasn't running it. So there was quite a backlog of stuff to fix. And but we sort of assembled this little ragtag group of people. And then what we tried to do is just focus in on just the core of folks that love us. And there's this little slice, you know, of folks that they want more than Trello, you know, because they want GitHub integration and they want Slack integration, but they don't want Jira. Like, Jira's killing them, right? And we had some special features, like you could manage multiple projects in it. So if you were a custom dev shop, Sprintly was really good, dead simple, clean project management tool to use for that. So we just focused on that. And that was a super fun business to run for a while. And, but then, you know, so Joe and I ran it together. And then at one point, Joe bought out my shares and ran it by himself for a while. And then the last I heard, a customer bought it.
Oh, wow.
From Joe. And I think they're running it now.
Interesting.
Because I had some email exchange with a guy, and I was like, who are you? And he's like, I own Sprintly. And I'm like, oh, I still have the password for the Facebook account.
Stuff like that. That's funny.
And so, and so I, and he was a customer. So I think that's where it's at now. So, but we didn't, you know, grow the thing really big and turn it into some, because that's impossible in that space.
Yeah.
But what we did do was kind of just make it stable, keep the people that were using it happy, and just ring the cash register every month, really. I mean, it was a neat, is, continues to be a neat little business.
Very interesting. Well, before we wrap up, I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak about anything that you really wanted to talk about today on the show, if at all.
Oh, that's so open-ended, my goodness. Well, you know what? When you guys called me and you said, well, we have this thing and it's Art of the Fail or whatever, and I was thinking about how, yeah, we don't really talk about our failures that much. And then I was like, well, what failures do I want to talk about? And, you know, it got me, it actually sparked this kind of deep thinking.
As it does.
About how, like, I'm failing all the time. Like, I failed this morning with the breakfast thing. But I don't think about it that way, like, in my mind, right? I don't think about it as failure. Like, I literally made a list. Like, let's make a list of professional failures of April Dunford, right? So, and I listed a whole bunch of things, right? Never should have took that job. Never should have launched that product. Never should have done this thing. Like, listed a bunch of things. But every single one of them, like, what happened as a result afterwards was cool, and I kind of couldn't have got there without things going off the rails before that. And so as a result, I was having a hard time, you know, really calling a thing a failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though, you know, like, if I looked at, like, well, we could get into, like, individual product campaigns that I ran that I was like so sure we're gonna be good, and you know, we did a little test and it looked okay, and I'd be like, no, this is gonna be great, and they'd be running and like, no, it's not great at all. Like, we just blew 30 grand on that thing. But you know, you learn so much from doing those. You know, you have a few really big flameouts, and then you learn, okay, I'm not going to do that again. And if I could have done that all over. And like, even in the process of writing my book, like, there were like, I attempted to write this book for like 6 years, and my first handful of attempts at it were total failures. Like, you know, first I thought I would write it myself, and then I started a new business with a business partner, and so I had this idea that me and the business partner could write it together, and then it turned out my business partner was a terrible, like, just not a good business partner for me, and so we went our separate ways, and then I put the whole book thing on the back burner for a while, and then I thought, well, I co-author would make this good, and especially if I had a co-author that knew something about books and written a book before. So then I got a really good friend of mine, and he's a super smart guy, and he's written a bunch of really amazing books. So we had this kind of year-long conversation about doing a book together, but he was really busy, I was really busy, he's not really a marketing guy, and so we were trying to get aligned on the topic, but it turned out I had this positioning thing burning, right? So us getting aligned on the topic consisted of me trying to convince him that we were just going to write my book. And then I was like, why am I doing this? And then, you know, we decided to not do that anymore. And then, yeah, so it took me forever. And then, you know, I spent a lot of time with a publisher, but then I decided publishers are idiots and they don't actually do anything for you. So then I got rid of my publisher, and then I decided to self-publish. Like, but in the end, am I super happy with where I got to in the end? Yeah. Like, had I actually been successful any of the previous versions of trying to do this book, it would have been way worse than where I ended up today. So even though it took forever to get it out, and literally my friends, when I finally did release the book, they were like, I got to be honest with you, April, I've been hearing this story about you doing the book for like 6 years, and I really didn't believe you anymore, and congratulations. But I'm happy to where I got to. So again, I don't know, maybe all your people say this when they come on the show, but I had a hard time sort of putting things in the failure bucket, mm-hmm. even though they were clearly failures.
So absolutely. That's pretty much the conclusion we come to at the end of every podcast, which I think will end up making the podcast obsolete at some point. But I think it's interesting, right? And I think what a lot of folks have issues with, ourselves included, I'm sure, is, and I'm curious, just on a final note, How do you think about it when you face those challenges in the moment? So when you're going through the co-author debacle and the publisher.
Yeah, like the failure bits.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, you've come out the other end of it. How?
Well, you know, so one thing is, like, one thing that really bugs me is when, you know, you fail at something and you'll be out of the bar going, ugh, I did this stupid thing and I just wasted a year and blah, blah, blah. And your friends say, no, you didn't. It'll all be great. And don't worry. You know, you'll look back and say this is. And they're right. But I do think that it is important to grieve your failures a little bit and like let people have their moment of, God, that sucked. Like, I think you actually, we should be better at this, at letting people, you know, live with their failure and not be so quick to like, forget about it. Blah, like, because it sucks. Like you just lost a year, and like you actually did lose a year of your life. And yeah, later you will feel better and things will be better. But you're not. But today it's not.
Huh, yeah, I don't think we've ever heard that one before. Very and tactical.
I think we should actually be allowed to feel bad, and people should comfort us in our feeling bad and say that does suck, April. You did lose a year of your life, and I'm buying the drinks tonight, and. Man, I hope things look better in a couple of months, but I get you, man. This is painful. And but we don't do that. Instead, we try to wipe it away. We try to pretend there's no pain on the earth. And that's not true. Like, we're all living through painful things right now. And I don't feel like we're sympathetic to that. Like, we're all failing at something right now. And if I'm sitting at the bar going, oh, I failed, the last thing I want is for someone to say, yeah, that's irrelevant. You'll be fine in a day. And this is just a hot minute in your life. And let me tell you about my shitty stuff or whatever. You know, like you should be able to say like, yeah, that actually sucks. And, you know, and maybe dissect it a little bit or something. And, you know, which is what you're going to do anyway. But I think we need to let people sit with their failure a little bit instead of just trying to make like it's not a thing. I mean, eventually it isn't a thing, right? Eventually, like you say, all your guests come on here and say, oh, now that I look back on it, it wasn't a fail. But let me tell you, in the moment, it was a failure. In the moment, it totally sucked. In the moment, I was like, what have I done? I lost another year doing this thing, and I'm all bummed out for however long it is. But I think that's part of the process. We have to go through that. And I think we should acknowledge that these things are painful and crummy. And I think we have mental illness and things because we're not allowed to sit with our pain. And everybody around us is saying, just forget about it. Forget about it. It'll be fine. Forget about it. And I'm like, no, I just wasted a year of my life. I'm allowed to sit here and cry in my beer.
Wow. What a neat perspective. I think we could all share a beer here. Alex, this is a test to see if there is a failure here. Do you know how we usually close off the show?
Oh, boy. We need your guy. Where's your guy? Like, he's not allowed to be sick.
What? I know. Christian, you're fired.
I say bye, and we shut the cameras off.
So, so April, the way we
black. That's how we.
Yeah. So, April, the way we usually close off the show is by asking our guests who they would like to see come on a show like The Art of the Fail to speak about their story. So, now you can see, you know, the crafty little marketing tactic we're using here, but I'm just genuinely curious. We've had people mention folks that are not even alive anymore. You know, whose story would you really resonate with when it comes to hardships?
Well, so, you know, right now I'm on this book tour, and so I'm speaking at a lot of conferences. And so the neat thing about speaking at a lot of conferences is you get to see a lot of speakers that, you know, this year I'm doing something like 40 conferences. Like, I would never attend 40 conferences in a year ever in my life if I wasn't writing a book. And so you get to see all these really neat people get up on stage and do their bit. So, and some of these people have incredible stories. I don't know if you've had Patrick Campbell from Profitwell on here.
No, we haven't. No,
you should. Like, he has an amazing story about running a startup, and you know, at one point he gets really sick and he's got cancer, and it's an amazing story that he does at conferences. And if you haven't had him on, you should have him on, because his story is kind of like, holy man.
Patrick Campbell.
Yeah, Patrick Campbell, he's a good one. And then you know, another one I saw sort of recently, but he would be a harder get, frankly, is Dan Ariely, who did the book Predictably Irrational. Okay. And he's got a great story about, you know, how he started to think about how we make decisions and why people do really irrational things. Hmm. And his story is, you know, from having been, you know, burned on 80% of his body, and he was in the hospital forever. He had this super painful thing, and the way they were changing his bandages was like horrifyingly painful. And he just could not understand why the nurses were doing it that way. And so he ended up getting really interested in the psychology of that and you know, why we do irrational things and we don't. But anyways, he's got an incredible story. Wow. Which is a super powerful thing to hear when you see him do it at a conference. So he'd be a great one.
Awesome.
If you could get him, he's kind of like fancy university professor or whatever. Like, I first met him when he was at MIT, and I was working at a company and we were doing some stuff with MIT, and so I met him there. But so he's a neat one. But yeah, I think
very cool.
I think maybe that's enough too.
Yeah. Those are super super interesting topics, super interesting people. Awesome. April Dunford, the book is obviously awesome. You can get it on Amazon or anywhere you can get your books. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We had a blast. Alex, thank you for co-hosting.
Yes, thanks, April. Thanks, Chris, for having me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, awesome. Have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you too.
Well, there you have it. Another episode of The Art of the Fail in the Bag. Thanks so much for listening to this one. You can support April by visiting her website at aprildunford.com. And you can buy her book. It's obviously awesome. You can get it on Amazon. And don't forget to install the free Obi browser extension, the fastest access to your work documents. You can get that at obi.ai/personal. See you next time.